Okay, here with Ryan Ballingy, managing editor of Back Nine. Ryan, honestly, is Stevie Williams the worst high fiver of all time?
He has a terrible track record with the high five, but Adam Scott seemed to have salvaged the one for an 18. You know, when he won on the next hole, on the next playoff hole in 10, it wasn't quite as good of a moment. But considering that it was Australia's first major or first Masters title in 77 tries, I think there's some forgiveness there for awkwardness.
You'd think all the success that he's had as a caddy over his career, Stevie Williams would have figured out how to perfect what is rather simple maneuver.
Well, considering he can't even have the decency to put a shirt on underneath that white jumpsuit, I'm not really expecting a whole lot of Steve Williams.
I was really worried about the sideways rain soaking the entire suit.
Well, he does have quite a bit of carpet in there, so that was what I was more worried about than anything else.
You mentioned Australia. It's obviously a big deal for Australia, the fact that this was their first Masters championship. Do you think this all but helps Adam Scott forget about Royal Lithuania last year?
I think it helps, but I don't think he ever forgets. I think you forget the defeats more than you remember the wins sometimes. I hope Adam Scott's not that guy. It doesn't seem like he is, or otherwise he probably wouldn't have gotten this far and won the Masters. But it is kind of crazy to think, and I hope he never thinks this way, but I certainly will at some point, and I thought about it today. He's one stroke away from winning two of the last three majors, and I put that out on Twitter, and someone very astutely replied to me, he's also one stroke away from having zero majors. So it's that big of a difference. It is one stroke in having two majors or zero, and in the case of Angel Cabrera having two majors or having three and being an instant Hall of Famer.
That's funny about Cabrera because he was 269th in the world going into the week.
Yeah.
And I don't follow it enough to really be able to tell you that he had any chance whatsoever heading into play. But I wonder what it is about Augusta for this guy. He just seems like he has the game for the big moments, and he can drive the absolute snot out of the ball, and he makes the big putts, and there he was in the end.
Yeah, and that's really all it boils down to is can you shoot 73 times or 70-ish three times in one round in the 60s, and you could probably win. And that's more or less what he's done. He obviously, 09 was a little bit of a different game where you had to go a little bit lower to keep up with Kenny Perry and Chad Campbell, but for whatever reason, he can bust it a long way. He hits it with a lot of confidence. He doesn't have a lot of fear around the golf course, probably is to steal from Tiger. The shots, shapes fit his eye. And I think he probably felt a little inspired to have his kid on the bag and say, look at this 43-year-old man. He could still do it. He could still play. And to be frank, I mean, he's got the kind of power a la Kenny Perry to be able to contend in this Masters for another decade if he wants. It's just a matter of whether or not he can putt.
He also enjoys a good cigarette now and again.
Or 10,000, whatever.
Unfiltered. So really, Adam Scott defeating Angel Cabrera in a playoff hole is truly a win for athletes worldwide when you match him up with the chain-smoking Argentine.
Yeah, if you put it that way. But then you can always make the parallel to Major League Baseball. I mean, it's not. I mean, obviously, athleticism has improved tremendously in Major League Baseball in the last 20 years, and the same is true in golf. But there are still standouts. There are still golfers who don't exactly believe in the fitness regimen that Dustin Johnson believes in. But that's not what's required to be a champion golfer. You just have to have enough moxie and hand-eye coordination more than anything else. And Angel Cabrera's got it, even with a cigarette out of his mouth.
Moving forward, where do you think this leaves the long putter debate? Now that Adam Scott wins the 2013 Masters, and that's something like, I don't know how many, is it something consecutively, or certainly, I just saw something about how now all four majors have been won by someone using a long putter.
Yeah, the anchored stroke grand slam has been completed in the last six major championships, dating back to Keegan Bradley winning the 2011 PGA Championship over Jason Duffner in that playoff at Atlanta Athletic Club. So he won the PGA Championship. Webb Simpson won the U.S. Open with the long style putter. Ernie Els won the Open Championship last year with the belly putter, although is since going to abandon it after this week. And Adam Scott wins the Masters with the long putter. So they got four in six, and that's pretty incredible to think that anchors have won four of six majors, and the guy who's won the other two is Rory McIlroy.
So do you think it changes the discussion, adds to it, puts more pressure on the USGA and REA to revise their earlier statement and kind of acquiesce to what the PGA Tour is saying?
I think it makes them more steadfast in their approach now, because they want the ban to prevent players from growing up thinking that this is an okay way to putt. And the more guys that win major championships putting this way, the more acceptable it becomes. It's just a natural evolution. So I think the governing bodies, and now Augusta National, because I can assure you they did not want this to happen. I'm sure they're happy that an Australian and a good-looking guy won the Masters, but they sure as hell aren't happy that the guy with an anchor putter won the Masters. And I think that's going to drive this forward, and they're just going to say to Tim Fincham, either you create two sets of rules or you stick with us, but we're getting rid of the anchored stroke whether you like it or not.
I wonder how, because Adam Scott seems like he's an incredibly popular player on tour. I wonder, you know, what other golfers who don't use the long putter think about occurrences like this and where the debate's going and whether or not a win like today for Adam Scott is certainly my sense is that players feel as if he was long overdue for a moment like this just because of his talent, regardless of what kind of putter he uses. What do you think your sense is around the tour?
Well, if you look at how he putted for the first 17 holes of the round, putted like crap. I mean, he was terrible.
It wasn't good. Yeah.
He had no business winning this tournament.
He would have been up. He would have been up something considerable heading into the last few holes if he were hitting putts, probably, huh?
Yeah, if he was putting better, this would have been a rout. It wouldn't have been that interesting. So thank God he putted like crap for the first 17 holes. But on 18, and then in the playoff on number 10, huge putts. But I don't think tour players think that's a function of him using the long putter versus the short putter. I don't think they see it that way. I think a lot of tour players want the anchored stroke banned, but they understand that Pandora's box has been opened for 30 years, really, and there's not much that can be done now. At least that's their view. I disagree with them, but I think that's the prevailing sentiment.
Speaking about changes to rules, I'm talking with Ryan Ballingy, managing editor of Back Nine Network. So be honest, how much credit right now are you taking for Tiger Woods being able to play through the weekend?
Very, very little. I just think it's an interesting side note more than anything else to have.
You have to explain it now.
Okay. So in 2011, at the Hyundai Tournament of Champions, which is the winner's only event to kick off the PGA Tour season, well, it won't be anymore, but it used to be. And Camilo Vijayas was hitting a shot at the 15th hole. It's late at night. I was at my house. He hit a shot at Kapalua, and it didn't go far enough up a ridge, and it was coming back toward him. And he was trying to do the right thing, I think, and he moved this big piece of turf from a divot somebody else took. Maybe he took it, I don't know. But a big piece of divot. And he moved the divot as the ball was rolling in that general direction of the piece of turf, because he thought the good idea was to let the ball roll out as much as it humanly could. And it turns out he was breaking the rules, and this writer, Dave Andrews, who's a friend of mine, shot me a note, I think it was on Twitter, and said, "Hey, I think Camilo Vijayas broke a rule. What do you think?" And I had it on DVR, and I went back and watched it. And yeah, he did break the rules. And he was like, "Well, what do I do? Do I call the PGA Tour? Who do I get in touch with?" And I said, "Well, I know somebody. I will email the media official." And I emailed him, but it was too late. By the time they had gotten it, Vijayas' round was over. He'd signed for his score. And the PGA Tour reviewed the footage with Vijayas and said, "Yes, you did indeed break one of the rules of golf by moving that piece of divot." and therefore you didn't assess yourself the penalty associated with it, and therefore you signed for an incorrect scorecard, and therefore the penalty is you are disqualified. And I'm sure Camilla doesn't like me very much for that incident, but a couple of weeks later in Abu Dhabi, a very similar thing happened to Patrick Harrington. And the USGA and RNA came together and said, well, we still think TV viewers can call in and snitch on players that break the rules, but we'll amend Rule 33-7 with a decision that says that tournaments can decide not to disqualify players if they unwittingly break a rule that could not have been known, made known to them, were it not for modern technology like video, like the internet. So that's kind of the way what happened with Camillo and my small involvement with that led to what ultimately kind of kept Tiger around. That, and also the fact that Augusta National didn't think that Tiger violated the rules until he opened his big fat mouth on television and said he dropped the ball 2 yards behind the original spot, which is not close enough for Rule 26-1. And so they realized they made a mistake. They also realized Tiger made a mistake, and they had to assess him a penalty, but they couldn't disqualify him because then it would come out that they told him there was no problem. And that would be a huge reversal. And so this was the best way they could both save face.
With, you know what, if Camilo Villegas is really trying to get back at you, what he should do is swap out all of your HD TVs for some transistor radios. That way you can't, next time around, you can't snitch on him.
Well, the funny thing is, there was an email attributed to him to me a number of years back that he, right after the incident, really. And he called me. Oh, no, it was from a different thing, actually. Another thing I wrote.
Wait, you tried to get him again?
No, I got him even before this.
What do you have against Camilo?
I really don't. The 2011 incident was just incidental, but I think it was 2009 or 10. Camilo complained about having to play so often in the FedEx Cup, like four, you know, we have to play 4 weeks in a row and 7 out of 8 and all this stuff. And I wrote this big, long, scathing post at my blog at the time, Waggle Room, and just laid him a new one. How dare you complain about playing for $68 million combined purse over 8 weeks and all the prestige you can win and all of this stuff. And meanwhile, I'm sitting behind a computer typing for a free stipend, just running this golf blog. How dare you complain about being able to make so much money? Well, he sent me an email after that, basically calling me a jealous loser. Of course, loser spelled with two O's, spelled wrong, and not very well written. And it was attributed to him that the email address is CamilloVillegas@gmail.com or something like that. But I saved the email. I still have it. But I don't know if it ever was actually him. I never went up to him at a tour that was like, hey, I'm the jealous loser you wrote the email to.
Jealous loser and a jealous loser. So you have not been able to verify if that was in fact Camilo Villegas who sent you that nasty email?
No, I haven't, although I would like to someday, but I kind of forget about it until every time a rules violation like this comes up, then all the memories come flooding back.
I also like that his email account is literally CamilloVillegas@gmail.com.
Well,
you would think it would be something else.
Believe it or not, a lot of professional golfers are not all that bright about it. They are literally their name at gmail.com or hotmail.com or whatever it is. They're not creative.
Moving it back to the discussion about rules violations, you've been instrumental in a previous decision, as you just described. You know, golf is really one of the only sports, maybe the only sport, where this type of activity happens, where people watching at home can get through, first of all, the rules officials and change the outcome of an event. I don't know about you, but I was struck after Tiger posted that score and all the stuff started to boil over on Saturday morning. I was struck by how many people were really personally offended by once they decided to dock him 2 strokes and not disqualify him. I was amazed at how many people, you know, on speaking on television, on Twitter, wherever, were personally offended by Tiger's decision to continue playing, as if he had somehow done something incredibly wrong to the game of golf. I don't know where you fall on this debate, but what are your feelings about Tiger's decision to continue to play, and how do you feel about people taking his decision so personally as if they are somehow involved?
I don't think there's some kind of, it's not like Immanuel Kant is sitting around with a moral imperative. You must disqualify yourself, Tiger.
No, it's not Immanuel. It's not Immanuel Kant. It's actually Bobby Jones. whose name was evoked several times on the coverage on Saturday morning. I forget what station it was, either Golf Channel or ESPN, I think, evoked the spirits of Bobby Jones, Walter Hagen, and you name it.
Yeah, I think several people said, well, so-and-so would have disqualified themselves, and so-and-so would have disqualified themselves. And so, well, all those people, either if they're still alive or they're dead, weren't around in this era of coverage. They would have never been caught in this fashion. I don't think you can accurately describe how they would have reacted to it. But the rules of golf have since been amended to allow for things like this to be more or less absolved with penalty. Tiger was penalized, and because of the bad break that he got at number 15, it ultimately cost him four shots. It cost him potentially a birdie if the ball doesn't hit the flagstick and goes in the water. It cost him the two shots and obviously cost him the penalty shot. So if he doesn't have that four-stroke difference, maybe he wins the Masters. So I think he paid quite a penalty by not disqualifying himself, because he's going to be able to sit at home for the next 60 days until the U.S. Open comes around, and maybe for the rest of his life if he never gets to Jack Nicklaus's 18, and go, if that ball didn't carom off that damn flagstick, I might have beaten Jack Nicklaus's record. And we will never know what the outcome could have possibly been had that not happened. That to me is enough of a penalty.
You can understand how flustered he must have been in that moment. And it, I mean, holding him to certainly the standard that all golfers are held to, I get. But I think we all know what he was trying to do. And he obviously mixed up some of the rules. He thought he could go back a few yards because that's where the ball entered the water. At least that's what he was thinking. But he couldn't. Is that the correct?
I think maybe he thought a loose interpretation of as nearly as possible was either that, or he thought the rule was within one club length, which more or less is 2 yards. That's fine. And I think maybe he just mixed up an interpretation of what he was supposed to do there. And Augusta National looked at the footage, and they decided that he didn't break a rule. And then he opened his mouth, and he basically said, I broke a rule, unwittingly saying that. And so they had to do something about it because they were on the wrong side of the decision. And that's kind of why it played out this way. I think it worked out for the best for everybody other than Tiger, obviously, because the Masters got a champion without controversy. And they come out looking like they did the thing that they had to do to keep the tournament's sanctity, this particular one, intact. And ultimately, Tiger's the guy who gets a little screwed here. But them's the breaks, I guess.
Well, what do you think compels a person to call in? You've been in this position, as you described, in 2011 with Vijegas, but someone who was watching alerted Masters officials to, was it Tiger's drop or his comments after the round? And then someone called in and said, hey, you might have a situation on your hands. Otherwise, the Augusta officials didn't know anything about it or didn't think anything about it. Like you said, they already cleared him of any wrongdoing. So let me ask you, like, going back to 2011 with your situation with the Hyundai Tournament of Champions, why is it that people watching golf, and you're not just anyone, you're connected to the sport, but why is it that people watching golf feel entitled to participate in the rulemaking, and you don't even get anywhere close to this in any other sport? Imagine just drawing a parallel to baseball or basketball, and you have a controversial call, let's say in the NCAA tournament, like the championship game, there was that really close jump ball, I think it was the national semifinal game between Wichita State and Louisville. So there was that jump ball call, and everyone was like, whoa, the player didn't, you know, he didn't have time to tie him up. You got to let him play it out. And the ref called it, and Louisville got the ball back, and we all know what happened there. What if people don't feel entitled and compelled to call in and complain about rules violations and calls that are made with officials' discretion in other sports, but yet golf, as you've done as someone did this weekend? Why is it that people feel that they have a line into golf officials where they can make some sort of difference? Is that about the sport? Is that about the kind of people who enjoy golf? What is it?
Well, I think people who follow all sports or fans of all sports, I think some percentage of them feel compelled to call the NFL office in New York or the Major League Baseball office or the NBA office and choose somebody out for a crappy call that hurt their team. But the difference is in golf, those calls can actually result in something happening in real time or retroactively because a golf tournament happens over 4 days. So there's time to review it. There's time to go back and assess a penalty. It's not all decisions are final. That's just the way the game is. Until the tournament is over, no decision is final. And that makes it really interesting and unique to other sports. But there's a big difference also in golf that there are not enough rules officials to police all of the action that happens in a tournament, even as one is as small as the Masters is and is as exclusive as the Masters is. And so I think there's no way of perfectly refereeing golf. And I think that's where fans who call in rules violations come from. They are the police that cannot be there for every rules official that's off somewhere yelling at Tianlin Guan for being so damn slow, while somebody else could be unintentionally breaking the rules of golf and hurting the integrity of the game. Because what if somebody didn't call in that violation and Woods didn't get the penalty? Mm-hmm. Then maybe all of a sudden Tiger has a totally different MO and he gets into the final group or he gets into the playoff and he wins. Then what? Then there's an asterisk next to this championship because somebody didn't enforce the rules properly. And I think for whatever reason, golf fans who make these phone calls take that much more to heart because there's no instant replay and they're trying, I believe, really are coming from a good place and trying to protect the whole field. And because they realize there's not a mechanism to go back instantaneously and say, hey, Tiger, you broke a rule, add two strokes and move on with your life, that's why they do it. And until there's a point in the game of golf where there is some form of instant replay and players can just be docked on the spot, I think this will continue to happen.
The one point of contention that I would take with all that is that it just seems bizarre to me that there are people who aren't directly involved with the event who feel as if they are somehow guardians of the game. And for what you're saying is pretty much that the lack of rules officials necessitate that there be people who are almost serving as honorary rules officials. So that is definitely something unique to golf. You can't find that in any other sport. I mean, certainly where fans, I don't think fans, maybe fans might call into the NFL league office, but they don't feel as if they have to protect the integrity of the game like it sounds people who call in about rules violations do with golf.
But, I mean, if you go to like a basketball game or if you watch me watch a basketball game, have you ever not screamed at the TV and gone, that's traveling, that's 3 seconds?
Yeah, but you're not going to pick up the phone and call into the head of officials and expect some sort of change.
That's absolutely true, but I think that for the people who are willing to go that extra mile and place that phone call or go look online where to email rules violations, that's just their MO. They're taking it that one step, maybe too far, but ultimately, the big incidents we've had over the last couple of years, Camillo, Harrington was actually in contention at the time after the first round. Camillo wasn't, he didn't really have a prayer. But this is really the first time when a viewer calling in, other than with like Craig Stadler kneeling on a towel 30 years ago, that this really had a significant impact on a tournament in a big situation. So I think this is going to be something that's going to be discussed for a long time, and I imagine the ruling bodies will look at their interpretation of this rule, and maybe they'll change it. I don't know.
I guess I do have a slight issue moving forward with you know fans' involvement and the ability to affect the outcome of an event like seemingly fans are able to do with golf, and the other thing is, I can't believe the PGA or whoever publishes any kind of contact information that would allow anyone to get so close to somebody who could actually make one of these decisions.
Well, really, you just have to be able to find their main office phone number, and that's what people do. They call the main office, and someone, polite person, goes, "Hi, this is the PGA Tour. How can I direct your call?" And someone goes, "I want to report a rules violation." That's pretty much the end of it, and they direct you to the right person.
I'm gonna do that next time I don't like a strike three call.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, the PGA Tour has told me in the past that they have people who call on a fairly routine basis with what they perceive to be rules violations, and they're not even close. So I kind of feel bad in all of this for the PGA Tour, who will probably see an uptick in calls from people who are like, "I want to be the guy to catch Tiger in the act. I want to be the guy to screw over Phil Mickelson because I don't like how he gives that darn thumbs up," you know. So that's why I feel bad for in all of this. Tiger will recover. He'll probably win the U.S. Open by like 30. But the PGA Tour is still going to get a bunch of calls from people.
Yeah, I guess. Certainly it affected the outcome of the event. Tiger was rolling on Friday. I was secretly hoping he went into full FU mode this weekend and obliterated the competition, but he obviously didn't. It sounds like people are kind of split as far as if he should have disqualified himself. Vic Faldo was pretty adamant that Tiger should have done the manly thing, is what he said, I believe. That was the exact quote he said from what I caught on Golf Channel Saturday morning. He said the manly thing to do would have been to disqualify himself. I found that interesting. And then, but you have people like Fred Couples who was at that point, I think, still very much on the first page. And he said that this is, the ruling, the two shot stroke, penalty was good for the game. The interpretation was good for the game moving forward. So that's different from Tiger disqualifying himself. But where do you fall in this whole, should Tiger have done the manly thing and disqualified himself, or did he take his punishment and he did the right thing by continuing to play?
I think he took his lumps. I mean, obviously he lost, and obviously the long-term impact of this could be immeasurable for years to come. But in isolation, I think it's actually a good thing, because maybe it does discourage some fans from making phone calls because they think they got Tiger or they got somebody and they're going to get them disqualified. And that's not going to happen. They're just going to get a slap on the wrist and whatever associated penalty with the rule they couldn't know. But I do not think personally that this rule was applied properly by Augusta National. If they used the 33-7 decision, the interpretation, I think that was wrong. But ultimately, 33-7 is a rule that most people will remember for the rest of their lives now. But what it means is that any tournament can overturn a disqualification for any reason. And until that rule changes, that's the same set of rules that everybody plays under. And if it happened to another player, if it happened to Yo Ishikawa and they gave him two strokes and he made the cut anyway, then I think no one would be calling for Yo to pull out of the tournament. They'd say, "All right, well, great, you're going to collect a paycheck." But I think because it was Tiger, and because he was close to the lead and he was in contention, they thought almost kind of backwards that he should pull himself out of the tournament, because God forbid he wins. And if he was nowhere near the lead, no one would have been telling him to pull out. They would have said, "Well, doesn't matter. He's not going to win anyway."
You mentioned, and just two more quick ones for you, Ryan. You mentioned earlier, the 14-year-old Guan and the penalty for slow play. Did they single him out unfairly? It seems as if everyone was playing at a ridiculously slow pace. There was reports of 5.5+ hour rounds out there on Friday, which is another problem for another podcast. But did they single this poor kid, this 14-year-old, which frankly was a great story. I mean, he's an eighth grader. He's 14 year olds. He's the youngest ever to compete at Augusta National. And here he is walking down the fairway with a rules official explaining to him that he's going to be penalized a stroke for slow play. I couldn't help but feel kind of sorry for the kid. Was he singled out?
I felt sorry for him. And I don't know that he was singled out so much as he was the victim of being observed by a guy who the referee was John Paramore, who is an excellent official. He has no tolerance for slow play whatsoever. He injected himself in a World Golf Championships event a few years back, about 5 years back, with Patrick Harrington and Tiger Woods, going so far as to assess a penalty for them for being slow. And they're the final group. And I think what happened is Paramore didn't see Juan playing faster. And most pros have a B routine. Even if they're slow, when they know they're on the clock, they've developed an alternative way to get around the course and at least get the official off their back. Juan didn't have that, apparently, and that was what cost him a stroke. Do I think it's absolutely absurd that he got a stroke and like 25 other guys in the field didn't? You bet. But thank God he made the cut anyway and preserved a great story.
Yeah, why weren't they watching Bernard Langer?
Yeah, I mean, he is monolithic.
No question. Okay.
He's still wearing cargo pants.
He was wearing cargo pants, that's right, and a bright neon orange shirt. It's still a pretty cool story about this kid, 14. It's hard not to feel happy for him, even without the slow play penalty. Last one. Your biggest Masters disappointment this week?
Phil Mickelson. I really thought this might be, Montezuma's revenge almost, where he just craps on the field all week and dominated for what happened last year at the fourth hole. And he was just flat. And what was even worse about it all was that he was a whiner the whole week, that he was mad that the course was soft and that the field was accessible and there's not as much fear as there used to be about Augusta National. And I know he said all of those things in a calculating way because he wanted Augusta to ramp it up and he wanted them to make it hard, and he didn't perform. And I think that speaks really poorly of a guy who seemingly once a year, if not twice a year, goes out of his way to make a passive aggressive series of statements hoping for a certain outcome. And earlier in the year was about taxes of all things. And now he talks on matters about golf and can't back it up. That's a big disappointment to me.
I was actually, really intrigued by those comments he made after the first round about how easy the course is. Now he just has to start going at pins. I that was clearly directed at somebody.
Mm-hmm. And then he couldn't back it up.
What about what are your feelings about Rory McIlroy after this tournament? Have they changed at all?
No. I mean, it's too bad that he shot 79, but he played pretty poorly with Sergio last year in a group with some prominence. So he rounded out okay. I mean, he finished with an okay round. He's just not there yet. And this happens every year with Rory. There's some stretch of the year where he plays horrible golf and everyone goes, wait, isn't he supposed to be the next Tiger? And I think the answer has to be settled on. He is not. He's more, frankly, like Angel Cabrera than he is like Tiger Woods right now, where he will just come out of nowhere when you think he's dead in the water. And he will win something, and he'll win it by a lot. And you go, oh, wait, he's great. He should win all the time. And then he'll go back into his cave or go back on the WTA tour to go follow Caroline Wozniacki. And then he'll come back 6 months later and win a major. And I think that's going to be who he is. And if he wins 10 majors that way, great. But he's going to be a really frustrating guy to chronicle because he's not going to win 80 million events like everyone expects he's going to.
So moving forward this summer, you have to now play the role of prognosticator and pick for us. I'm going to have you pick the U.S. Open champ and give us two other storylines to look forward to in the next couple months.
All right. I think Tiger wins the Open. He has an appreciation of his sense of history, obviously. Ben Hogan has a big role to play in the history of Marion. I think he dominates it. He plays it like the 06 Open Championship, and you barely see a driver, and he wins by like five. I think the other storylines are anchoring will be banned. It's going to be official, especially now, another nail in the coffin from the governing bodies. And I think that there's going to be a really fascinating run toward the President's Cup this year, especially kicking off major season with Adam Scott winning a major. All of a sudden, it looks like while Americans won every event so far this year on the PGA Tour, except the last two. One went to a guy who's from Scotland, which is fine, but he lives in Colorado. And one went to a guy from Australia. And it'll be really interesting to see if the foreign players who have had such a hard time creating this weird coalition for the last decade and a half in this President's Cup competition maybe rally a little bit. And maybe they form a team and make this thing interesting in Muirfield Village in the fall.
I'm still sticking with my my Brandon Grace pick for the Open Championship.
I think it's a great track for him. I think Brandon Grace probably was a little overwhelmed this week, and he's going to have to gain a little bit of experience being thrust in these big game situations. But once he gets a handle on it, just like he did last year on the European Tour, he got a handle on winning. He won a lot. Once he gets a handle on it in these big stages, he'll do it.
That's my sleeper pick for the summer.
I think it's a great pick.
All right, Ryan Ballingy, Managing Editor of Back9 Network. Thanks for the time.
Of course. Thanks, John.
Yep, take care.